Session number 28626, Reel 11.
The army had decided they wanted to do an air mobility trial. So we then got, we basically prepared all our 432s and 436s, all our vehicles, were prepared to be handed over. And they went back into the system, so they were all backloaded. And we had this camp at the top of the hill, next door to the light infantry camp. And they were going to be our sister regiment in this air mobile trial. So we were going to have, effectively, most of the Army Air Corps and most of the Puma support helicopter force in Germany at our beck and call, done through our brigade headquarters, which was six brigade headquarters, who were just up the road from us in a place called Zost, commanded by Brigadier Dick Mundell of the Duke of Wellington. And we then got stuck in about this mobility trial. Now, the good thing from my point of view was I'd done the cyber course, I'd done my 4-day controllers course, and therefore I was, according to the experts, i.e. the COs, etc., I was the right man to take, or to reform the recce platoon, which had been, the recce platoons had been done away with in 1978. I don't know why they did it, they got rid of it, but they reformed them in 1983. And I, because of what I'd done, I ran a carder for potential recce platoon soldiers, and the companies put forward nominations of varying standards. The NCOs were very good, the soldiers were a mixed bag. But I ran a carder, and I was able to select from that carder 18 soldiers. And I based that carder on my experiences of the sniper course, because that's what reconnaissance people do. They have to be able to operate incredibly professionally in the field, because they're information gatherers. They mustn't be seen or heard. They've got to get the information through stealth, but be a potent force. And we also became the sniper platoon. So we had guys with dual capabilities, and it was a blessing from heaven for me. It was absolutely brilliant. I wouldn't say so from my wife's point of view, because I was not there then. We were there for 2 and a bit years, and I probably only spent 6 months there. The carder that I had run to select my soldiers was picked up by the army and became the basis of the course that was then run at Nethering for recce platoon commanders, which was, I found, really, you know, from my point of view, was really good news. But they had the information because I had just adapted it from the sniper course and put a few other things I'd learned in through my experiences as a young officer. But they took this thing. They got the copy of my 6-week program and took it away and created the recce platoon commanders course on the back of this, which was great. And I didn't get any money for it, but it was nice that I actually, somebody had seen that this was a workable 6-week course which would bring out all the necessary skills that a recce platoon commander would need. Now, I was a recce platoon commander in an air mobile role, in a dismounted role as such. Recce platoon commanders who are doing a mechanized role need different skills. So that course was still being conducted nearly always by the Royal Armoured Corps at Bovington, but this was a dismounted air mobile recce platoon. So I worked closely with the Army Air Corps Regiment at Zost, which I think is 3 Reg, if I remember right. And I nearly always worked with Lynx pilots and navigators. So we would have an empty Lynx would come forward quite often, and it would be supported by one of the Lynxes with the anti-tank weapons on the side. And we would put our troops in. I broke the platoon down into 6 4-man fire teams. Only 3 guys from each team would go out in the helicopter. The fourth man in each of these teams was the vehicle driver. Now, these guys had a hard job because these guys had to motor around the countryside. 6 Land Rovers, stripped down, you know, just no canopy, no windows, just a stripped down Land Rover with a GPMG machine gun on it, on a roll bar. They had to go around the country trying to find out where we were and work to a Liga, which would be 4 or 5 miles behind where we had been dropped off to do our job. So they had their own set of problems to do, because they had to be able to navigate superbly, communicate superbly, know what action to take if they're ambushed. They had a difficult job, and the corporal that I had, Corporal Count Eddie, he was the senior, he was the NCO in charge of the six vehicles. Now these guys' jobs were also to maintain those vehicles. I could not afford those vehicles not to work. So they were all slightly mechanically minded lads. They would do this. Caramelli was a first class signaller as well. So I had the right man in charge of these five other blokes, in charge of six vehicles, which were crucial, and they had to operate on their own and then marry up with us. We, the other six groups of three, 18 of us, would work in these three-man groups, and we would be flown in, dropped in an area, and then we had to go forward and clear an area which would become a landing zone for the support helicopters to bring the battle group into. So we had to clear it, make sure that it was big enough, that it was sensible, and it was free of enemy. And once they started to arrive, we were then sent forward 5 or 6 Ks, normally on foot, but occasionally we were lucky and we'd get flown forward, dropped off, and then we'd establish an observation post light, i.e. we'd dig into the ground, and we would live in the ground. We'd cover ourselves over and live in a bunker under the ground, basically, we created, and stay in there for however long was necessary. Sometimes it was as short as 6 hours, other times it was literally 8 or 9 days. And we were observing where the enemy were likely to come, infiltration routes for armoured forces. And we would do this with our night viewing devices, with our day scopes, with our rifles, sniper rifles, and we'd report this information back to our battle group headquarters. And Colonel George Kennedy was the CEO at the time. We had Keith Legg, Major Keith Legg was, well, he was Captain Keith Legg then, but he was the ops officer. And the important thing about our battle group was we had 44 Milan missiles. Now, the Milan was the portable anti-tank missile, which was fired from a tripod type of arrangement. It was wire-guided, and it sent a great big 120mm explosive head out on the back of this fin thing with a wire connected to it, and you, rather like the kids do so well with the remote-controlled sort of thumb action, they would fly this thing along a line to the target, and it had a range of about, I think it was 1950 or 2 kilometres out to its maximum. So they would create all these enormous anti-tank killing areas, and the company would get itself into a horseshoe shape, for instance, and they'd be able to fire forward or across each other into the centre of the killing area. And the companies were based over a big area. They weren't, they weren't all, sitting in the side of a football pitch. They would be covering an area maybe of 50 football pitches and looking in. So there'd be a platoon there, supported by a platoon here, supported by a platoon there. So we had all this, and every company had Milan. We had a mortar platoon, which would set up and do its normal mortar tasks. Quite often, that their job was to provide illumination, so that the boys could find Milan's at night. Now, the Milan has a thermal imaging device, but sometimes you could be swamped by so many burning objects that the thermal imager would actually cut out. So you had to have a loom to see it just ordinarily with your own eyes. So they did all that. And they had a lot of kit to do. They had to dig in, but they were operating together and supporting each other, while we were very much on our own. Three of us in a trench. The next trench might have been 600 yards away, but we had to be able to operate our own, and we had to be able to know what was going on, but not mark our maps because we were susceptible to being captured. So we did that for 2 years, and because we were doing well, my platoon, and that's why I was away for a long time, we were always being tasked to go and work with other foreign armies, the Germans, the Belgians, the Dutch, the Americans, to develop our skills, but also to help teach them various lessons about what you could and couldn't do. It was just the most fantastic experience.
But the area you were in as well, it sounds as though it would have been quite military friendly, was it? Because you're saying that, you drove so far or you went so far and that. And I was thinking, well, if it had been in a built-up area as such, I thought that would have been quite difficult.
We certainly, because we were, this is all war gaming, you know, we were working in Western Germany, you could they call it 443, where you go to an area and the army can take from the German authorities the right to train in an area. Any damage is paid for by the MOD. So because we were an air mobile battalion, we weren't driving tanks or 432s across farmers' crop. We weren't causing, I mean, very little damage in real terms, very little damage. Yes, we'd dig the odd hole here there, but they'd always be filled in the end of the exercise. Where I was working, you know, you could be in somebody's back garden, somebody's shed, somebody's attic. and the secret was, they mustn't know you're there. So we were playing everything for real.
Okay, and was there situations like that where you might have been in someone's back garden or something?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the secret was not to get caught. You know, that's the whole point of this operative routine, is to gain information without being seen. Stealth. And that's what we did. And we had a very successful platoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Gibson.
Afternoon,
how are you? Hello. Last time I spoke to you, we were discussing your period in 1983 to 1985.
Yes, in Germany, in Heimat.
Yeah, I thought we would just continue, and if you could maybe tell us a bit more about the Ricky platoon that you were organising and the courses, I think, that you were running, were you?
Yeah, absolutely. I came back to the Gordons in 82, and it was a sort of company command of a headquarters company. But when we moved to Germany, Lieutenant Colonel George Kennedy was the commanding officer, and he got me in and said, "Right, Morris, we're going to reform the Recce Platoon." Now, I was the last Recce Platoon commander in the 77-78 tour of Ireland, and then Recce Platoons ceased to exist. It was to be reformed. And it was going to be reformed for the air mobile trial. So George Kennedy said, look, you have a small platoon, it's going to be 24 total, based on you, three senior NCOs, six corporals, and the remainder will be privates and lance corporals. You have got to run a cadre, so you'll have to go away and work out what you need to do and select the right number of soldiers from the people who are put forward by the companies. I said to Colonel Kennedy, I said, with all due respect, Colonel, I really know that we're going to get some pretty poor soldiers from the company. They're going to pass all the poorer soldiers to the Recce Platoon, because that's what will happen. And he said, no, you're quite right, that's what will happen. I will say something to the company commanders to try and prevent that, but I know you're going to get some fairly dodgy soldiers. And I said, well, one thing I would like, I don't believe I need three senior NCOs, I think one senior NCO, a sergeant, will be sufficient, because we're not mechanised, we don't need to have all this hierarchy, and that way you can use the colour sergeant and the other sergeant elsewhere. And he said, no, that's a good point, I will think about that. I said, well, I would want to have five decent full corporals, you know, and the rest can be privates and lance corporals, but, you know, five good corporals. And he said, right, we'll ensure that happens. And he said, I see what you're trying to do here. You've obviously thought about this, and this is good. So I went away. Now, having done the Recce, having done the sniper course, having done my forward air controllers course, having been at demonstration battalion for 2.5 years, I actually had quite a lot of knowledge about the way of developing a Recce platoon. So I went away and I wrote a 6-week cadre training course, which had all the physical aspect in it. It had recognition in it, because obviously we had to understand what the threat was, what vehicles the Russians had, the East Germans had, the Poles had, and so on. We had to know aircraft, we had to know the weapons they had, we had to know the capability of their weapons, how far their mortars could fire, how far their guns could fire, what to listen out for, this sort of thing. So that was all built in. The sniping art was obviously important, because we were going to be the snipers as well. So I had to make sure the shooting skills of the soldiers that I ultimately had was of a decent standard. I had to have people who could drive, so we had to make sure they could drive and do maintenance of vehicles, because we weren't going to be living and working in the pocket of the battle group. We were going to be on our own, some distance in front of them, maybe 10, 12 k's in front of them, as the eyes and ears, warning the battalion where the enemy were coming in from, so they could then deploy this huge anti-tank force that the battalion had. So I wrote this card, and sure enough, having written it up, having got my sergeant, Sergeant McDonald, 7-5, the Silver Fox, and my corporals, who were all, to a man, absolutely first-class men, all of whom, with the exception of two left the army as sergeants, but they left because they wanted to go out. The rest all made it through the system to warrant officers, all were commissioned. So, top quality men. I was given 24 soldiers from the companies, and I had to choose, I think it was 16 I had to choose at the end of the day. A few dropped out early on, inevitably, they just found it too hard and they just weren't the right guys. We had some discipline problems. I'm afraid in today's army I wouldn't be allowed to stay on, because my discipline was, if we've got a problem, we'll sort it amongst ourselves. We're not going to send a man in front of the company commander because he happens to have turned up 5 minutes late. We'll just sort it, and it won't happen again. And I think, to be fair, all the lads that I ended up with appreciated that style of management. So it was done and dusted. There was none of this sort of, we'll keep it going for days and days. Problem, spoken to, sorted, doesn't happen again. And that's the way it was. And so that worked well. I ultimately chose 16 of the 24. The truth was, there were only 18 left on the Qaeda. There were two that I turned down. Were disappointed. But I was only allowed 16, so these two lads had to go back to duty company. They went back to duty company as better blokes, without a doubt. But they weren't for me. I then was tasked by the commanding officer. He said, right, the Duke of Rossi's Dirk's coming up. You're going to be away, unfortunately. So I want your platoon to be involved in this. It's important. So we got involved in that, and we didn't do very well. Didn't do very well at all. And I came back, and the commanding officer gave me a debriefing about how poor the platoon were. But they'd only actually been together for about 7 weeks. They'd only just done the Qaeda. They'd been concentrating on the Qaeda rather than the Duke of Rossi's Dirk. And they were fit enough, but other skills weren't quite so good. If I take it forward a year, we then did the Duke of Rossi's Dirk again, because it's an annual competition. And we won it by quite a long way, which was great. And George Kennedy, the CEO, was delighted. And indeed, to be fair, a lot of other people were delighted that, you know, we turned around a situation which was pretty poor, and we had created a first-class platoon of soldiers who could be relied upon to do anything. And they had to be, because I'd send one of the fire teams, which is with three men, to work with a different company. And these guys, a corporal, maybe a lance corporal and a private, or a corporal and two privates, would go away and work with one of the other companies. And the company commanders were always impressed with the knowledge, the skill, the determination and ability of these lads to produce the goods, and provide them with the information they as company commanders needed. And that's exactly, you know, I couldn't have a better endorsement of the ability of these guys. So that was a big success. But it took a good 6-7 months, having done the Qaeda, to get them to believe in themselves and to follow the procedures that I, as the platoon commander and my sergeant, had laid down. Because procedures are a sure way of ensuring that things go off in a proper way. If you don't follow them, they'll go off half-cocked and they'll be a disaster. So we got them into this policy of following procedures, and through that, they developed and learned so much about themselves, about what they could and couldn't do. They learned how to shortcut some of the procedures without you know, creating too many problems. And the good thing was we met regularly, so we would discuss all these things, and we could, you know, we could say, okay, let's try that, and we would go away and try it before we do it in an operational or training environment. And the platoon was a really good success. We thoroughly enjoyed the role. We worked with the Army Air Corps, with Lynx helicopters mainly. Lynx helicopters in the utility role, so we were, they were troop carrying helicopters, and we would put two sections or two fire teams, six men in each Lynx, and we'd fly the Lynx out in advance. It would touch down or hover, and the boys would get out with all their kit, and then they would infiltrate their way forward to an area that I had selected off a map, where they would establish themselves in an OP. Most of the time they would dig in and camouflage themselves. Sometimes there wasn't the time to do that, so they had to just lie up and operate in a thick wooded area, and one person would go forward a 10, 12 metres to the edge of something and observe from there. But on the whole, we dug in, because we were, quite often, we were out there for days, if not weeks on end, in the same place. And therefore, you didn't want anybody to know that you were there. And this includes working in people's attics and, you know, garden sheds and stuff. So there was quite a lot of that going on. And, you know, it took 6 months for these lads to get on top of that and understand how to do it. And they did. They did very well, very well. And a lot of umpires, when we were doing exercises from America, from France, from Germany, were absolutely staggered how effective these guys were. They could sneak in, sneak out, and you'd never know they're there. But the information they brought back was absolutely right and accurate. And that was testament to these guys.
And how could they do something like that? You know, how could they go and be in someone's shed or attic and the people wouldn't know?
Well, it's a skill. You've got to take a risk. You've got to weigh up the situation. You've got to observe, let's say, a row of houses or a row of sheds and see what's happening there. When you go in to a shed, you'll know if it's used regularly. You'll know instinctively, because of the certain things that are there. I mean, if you went into my garage, you'd see that it's an awful mess, and you can hide away in some bits, but you can see the logic in the mess, and therefore somebody's probably in there getting chainsaws out or garden tools or something to clean the chickens out or something. So you need to be able to read these signs. It's no different to living in the field. You need to read the signs and understand about nature and work with it, not against it. Excuse me. So these guys would observe, you know, a row of houses, a row of sheds, and say, okay, this is the area we've got to be in. Our task here is to observe that house. Therefore, we can't be more than 50 yards away, otherwise we can't see it. So we've got to get in close. Now, if the garden's got a mass of shrubbery, fine. Has the house got a dog? If it's got a dog and there's lots of shrubbery, the dog will find you. No good, you've got to go somewhere else. This is all the stuff that I had to rely on them learning. When we obviously talked about it, we tried practicing it, but it only comes with experience.
But how did you learn it then? You know, if you were writing up this course work in the first place, how did you actually learn it?
I learned it for a combination of it being taught to us, first of all, at the Platoon Commander's Battle Course. There's a lot of teaching about this sort of thing. And you might practice an exercise. I then went on to use it when I was working in Ireland, the first tour, my 77, 78 tour, particularly when I was with the gunners in Flatstreetville. We did a lot of OP work, a lot of lurk patrols, where you would go into the dark shadows of some back alley or somebody's outside loo or something, and you would lurk there. You'd stay there for 4 or 6 hours observing. So you learn these skills, and you know, you learn about how to react if a dog comes out, because obviously they're going to find you pretty quickly on the whole, unless you're smelling the same as the surroundings. But it's all a question of acquired knowledge, and most of it needs to be done practically. Fine reading a book and someone telling you about it, but until you've actually done it, you just don't know if it's going to work. I can another example. You wouldn't believe how easy it is to cross an open field to approach an enemy position. If you pick the right night and it is dark and you've observed what their pattern is and how they're operating, you'll always find there's nearly always a blank area, which they are not looking into. And you can come across there, moving very slowly, crawling, whatever, but you'll get absolutely right in close and be able to do your job. So that these things are all acquired knowledge, they're all done through the practice makes perfect. And that's what we did. We did a lot of practice on this. Sometimes they were compromised and they had to bail out. And that's why, you know, they had to keep their kit on their bodies. They had to have their Bergens packed. They hadn't got time to take everything out and litter it around the OP, which unfortunately that's quite often what you do find in people who aren't trained in working in observation posts. Things are going to be stored away. So if the whistle goes, you've got to get out, you just pick it up and you're off, and you just run to your last RV.
Absolutely. Would you have had a lot of equipment with you, or kit with you, or how would you be dressed as well? You speak about camouflage, but what type of camouflage were you normally in?
Yeah, well, we certainly, if we were out, and we tend to be out for days, if not weeks, so we were carrying everything, including the kitchen sink. So we each of us would have our combats on. So we'd have our green disruptive pattern combats on, our boots. We'd have a web belt with the various pouches of ammunition, with perhaps a radio in it, first aid kit, some emergency rations, a knife or a bayonet, whatever. All the things you would take for survival if you lost your Bergen would be on your web belt or in your pockets of your jacket. You would have your ceramic when we first joined it was the old tin helmet, but then it became a ceramic helmet, which again had a DPM cover over it. Then you had this Bergen, and the Bergen itself was a big Bergen, probably a 75-litre Bergen as they're known today, but you would have perhaps as much as 85-100 pounds of weight in these Bergens. You've got water, you've got spare ammunition, you've got maps, you've got spare clothing, you've got batteries, because the radios went through things, and you didn't have a charger, so you'd have to take spare batteries. You might have another set, for instance, the UHF set, because I was a forward air. We were talking about camouflage, and just to reiterate, in the recce platoon, we wore our DPM, disruptive pattern material, combat trousers, jacket, and ceramic helmet with a DPM cover on it. When I first joined the army, we still had the old teal thin helmets and with webbing on, and sort of webbing over top of it, which are dreadful things. Anyhow, we got this issue combat suit. We would wear a web belt with pouches on it. In the pouches, we would have ammunition, radios, spare batteries, emergency rations, and all the survival kit that you might need if you were isolated from your Bergen, because your Bergen was your main carrying piece of equipment, but quite often it wasn't right next to you, it might be 10 yards away. So you need to have stuff on you which you could operate with. So you might have binoculars, you might have your bayonet or a knife with you. And all this stuff is stored around your waist. In your pockets of your jacket, you would have your standing operational procedures. You might have various coding cards for radio procedure. You might have your map case, first fuel dressing in case you got hit and you had to or apply it to yourself or to apply it to one of your buddies. So there's a lot of kit on you personally. You then had your rifle, and in our cases we had the GPMG, General Purpose Machine Gun. These were normally left with the vehicle, so the driver of the vehicle would hold that as his personal weapon, so it could be fixed to the mounting on the vehicle. So he would carry that. The guys going forward would carry a sniper rifle, an ordinary rifle, or an SMG, a submachine gun. So there was a variety of weapons. Now, the SMG was ideal because it was really a short-range weapon, and it was ideal for defending the locality. The sniper rifle was for the sniper work up to about 850, 800 metres. But the good shots could fire at 1,000 metres. Most of the work that we did was certainly a lot less than that, probably less than 500 metres, but that's just the way it was. And the SLR, the self-loading rifle, was a good chunky machine, and that was the number two to the sniper, so he would carry that. And that rifle, again, was fired accurately up to about 300 yards, 300 metres. on a regular basis. So there was, you know, a good variety of equipment there. The Bergen. The Bergen is the place where we took everything, including the kitchen sink, spare clothes, spare batteries.